Greetings and welcome to the Science Podcast for January 12, 2007. I'm Stuart Wills, the online editor of Science Magazine. Today, we'll talk about new paleontological evidence on migrations and distributions of early modern humans. We'll also look at some intriguing new results toward practical fuel cell vehicles and the genome sequence of the parasite behind a common sexually transmitted disease. All this, plus the usual roundup of other stories from science and its online daily news site, Science Now. So stick around. Leading things off today, a new look at an old skull. Genetic studies have suggested that modern humans moved out of Africa some 50,000 years ago, giving rise to the Paleolithic cultures that flourished in Asia and Europe. But while human fossils from this period are abundant in Europe and Asia, there's been very little fossil evidence from Africa itself to test the hypothesis. Now, in the January 12th issue of Science, Frederick Grine of the State University of New York, Stony Brook, and seven colleagues from the UK, Germany, South Africa, and Canada report on new age dating from a previously discovered hominid skull that puts the out-of-Africa story for modern humans on a stronger paleontological foundation. Dr. Grine joins us now from Stony Brook. Dr. Grine, welcome to the Science Podcast.
Thank you, Stuart. Thanks for inviting me to join you.
Well, Dr. Grine, although it is generally agreed, if I understand correctly, that modern humans originated in Africa, there has been some controversy about the details. Could you give our listeners a quick sketch of what these competing hypotheses are and what issues your study in particular is trying to address?
Well, Stuart, I think you've pretty well hit the nail on the head with your introduction. There's a general consensus among many geneticists that modern humans originated in sub-Saharan Africa and then migrated out to colonize the old world somewhere between about 65 and 25,000 years ago, which would correspond at least to the paleontological and archaeological evidence that we have in Europe dating back to about 35,000 years ago with the earliest material cultures for modern humans in Eurasia. However, there are a number of geneticists and genetic studies that disagree with this out-of-Africa notion. They postulate that there are significant contributions from archaic populations in Europe, such as Neanderthals or in Asia, to modern human populations. And they've argued that there is no evidence genetically for the bottleneck that would have taken place during an African migration out. On top of these two genetic hypotheses, as you pointed out, there is no paleontological evidence that could be used to test either one of these. There is a complete dearth of fossil evidence for humans in sub-Saharan Africa between about 70,000 years ago and about 15,000 years ago when this exodus is supposed to have taken place. And the significance of the specimen that we described in our Science article is the fact that it's been dated by a new technique or novel application of two other techniques to about 36,000 years ago, which would be the first paleontological evidence from sub-Saharan Africa that could be used to test the predictions of either one of these genetic models.
Well, let's look a bit closer at this fossil that you were looking at. As I understand it, this isn't actually a new find.
No, in fact, it was found, I believe, sometime in the early 50s, I believe it was 1952, I was found by a farmer in a dry riverbed and taken to the museum in Port Elizabeth, South Africa. And the curator or director of the museum at that time was Marjorie Courtney Latimer, the woman who discovered the coelacanth. And she went back to the site to see if they could find any kind of archaeological materials or anything else that may have indicated the age of this specimen, but there was absolutely nothing to be found. It was seems to have been a unique find. And the skull was then sent to Raymond Dart in Johannesburg, the fellow who described Australopithecus africanus, and they attempted to get a carbon-14 date for the specimen, but it was unsuccessful. No date's ever been published, and we found out subsequently that the reason for that is that there's no carbon left in the skull.
And so what did you do with this skull to get around that limitation?
The cranial cavity, the brain cavity of the skull, was completely filled with a very heavily cemented sand matrix. And I contacted colleagues of mine at Oxford University who were developing techniques for looking at sand grains and when they were deposited using a technique known as optically stimulated luminescence dating, and contacted them about the possibility of applying that technique to this specimen, and then went into the dark room of the South African Museum and prepared the sand out from the endocranial cavity, obtaining some samples that were deeply embedded and would not have seen light or sunlight since they were actually entombed in the skull. And I sent the samples to the lab in Oxford, and my colleagues came back with a date that they, interestingly enough, indicated at the first instance I would not be happy with. They suspected that I would like to have had a date of about 100,000 years when modern humans are supposed to have actually originated. But in fact, when they gave me a date of 36,000 years, I said, I'm perfectly happy with the date of 36,000 years because there's nothing else from South Africa or Sub-Saharan Africa at that time period.
Okay, so we know now that this skull is contemporaneous with fossils of modern humans from other continents, but how do we know there's any actual relationship between these populations?
Well, what we did was a two-pronged analysis using measurements of the skull. The first was using three-dimensional coordinates and then using traditional linear measurements of the skull. And both of these techniques have been shown to sort modern human populations in terms of their cranial morphology that were consistent with their genetic relationships and also with their geographic distributions. And we took the measurements of these skulls, and using two independent data sets, we compared them with contemporaneous specimens from Europe, the Upper Paleolithic modern humans, as well as with Neanderthals, some earlier modern humans from the Levant that date back to about 100,000 years ago, as well as large samples of modern humans from sub-Saharan Africa, as well as Europe and Asia. And the results were quite surprising. We had expected, or at least I had expected, that the morphometric affinities of this specimen would probably lie with the Khoisan, who inhabited southern Africa, we know, in the later Stone Age archaeological record. But in fact, the morphometric affinities of this specimen were very closely linked to the Upper Paleolithic specimens from Europe.
So you essentially had a technique where that had already been proved on modern human populations, and you applied it to tease out these relationships.
That's exactly what we did. Yes.
And okay, so now let's take all this together and just quickly, how would you to conclude here? How would you sum up the significance of this work?
I'd say that the skull that we have provides the first paleontological evidence that corroborates genetic evidence indicating that modern humans originated in sub-Saharan Africa and then migrated out at about 36,000 years ago to colonize the old world. And I'd suspect that this skull is perhaps providing us with the first insights into the morphology of this sub-Saharan African population, which basically means that when you look at this skull, you're looking at the face of our most recent common ancestor, irregardless of where we come from.
Well, Dr. Grine, thanks for being with us today.
Well, thank you very much for your time, Stuart.
Frederick Grine is the author, with seven colleagues, of a new paper documenting fossil evidence on the origins of modern humans. The paper appears in the January 12th issue of Science. Coming up in a moment, some recent progress toward practical fuel cells.
Did you know that the journal Science was founded by Thomas Edison in 1880? Even Edison's inventive mind could not have imagined its evolution into the world's leading journal of groundbreaking research and scientific news, in print and online. AAAS members can access seminars, podcasts, and all issues since 1880. Read today's stories and preview tomorrow's research, all at www.sciencemag.org. AAAS, advancing science into the future.
Next, fuel cells. For all the talk about a hydrogen economy and hydrogen's potential as a clean fuel of the future, the technical hurdles facing practical hydrogen vehicles are formidable. One of those hurdles lies in the development of efficient fuel cells to convert hydrogen fuel into electrical energy. Two new papers in Science report some progress on the fuel cell front, On the line to talk with us about them is science news writer Bob Service, who reports on the studies in this week's issue. Bob, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Well, first, Bob, some background. If I'm understanding these studies correctly, both deal with a particular type of fuel cell being developed for transportation applications, especially. Just how are these fuel cells supposed to work?
Fuel cells are like batteries in that they convert chemical energy into electricity, except that instead of throwing the batteries away when you're done or recharging them with fuel cells, you just add more fuel. In this case, the fuel is hydrogen gas, and each molecule of which is made up of two atoms of hydrogen. When these hydrogens hit a negatively charged electrode, called an anode, they split into two positively charged hydrogen atoms and two electrons. Now, the anode then swipes the electrons and sends them through a wire where they are used to power the car. And at the end of their journey, they arrive at a positively charged electrode called a cathode. At this electrode, the electrons pass two oxygen molecules. And this causes the oxygen molecules to split into pairs of oxygen atoms. The oxygens, which have a negative charge, then react with pairs of hydrogen atoms that traveled from the anode to produce water. So in the end, you start with hydrogen and oxygen and end up with water and electricity. So it's nice and easy and clean as long as everything works.
Well, okay, yes, as long as everything works, that's how they're supposed to work. What exactly are the problems here?
Well, the big problem with automotive fuel cells is the cathode. And the key ingredient here is platinum, which is an excellent catalyst for splitting oxygen molecules. Now, the trouble is that oxygen atoms produced here can react with other things as well. They often react with hydrogen atoms to produce something called hydroxide, and they can react with other things as well to produce other kinds of oxides as well. Now, these oxides readily stick to platinum atoms on the surface of the cathode, and when they do, they block those platinum atoms from doing their job of splitting oxygen molecules. And it's estimated that as many as 45% of all platinum atoms on the cathode wind up being blocked by these oxides.
So it's kind of a buildup of material on the cathode?
Yeah, and they just essentially sit there. They don't really do much. They just sit there and block access of the oxygen molecules to be able to get to the platinum sites that they need to react. And so it really reduces the power that the fuel cell is able to put out. Now, conventional fuel cells actually have a strategy for getting around this. They increase the electric potential of their cathode, and that essentially blows the oxides off, but that costs a lot of energy, and it lowers the efficiency of the fuel cell. And there's one other problem that oxides create, and that's that they tug on the platinum atoms rather strongly, and they can pull them right off the surface, and they cause them to diffuse into the electrolyte.
That would mean that the platinum would be sort of eaten away then over time, or
it's lost essentially, and so over time, that reduces the power put out by the fuel cell, and it eventually it would have to be replaced.
Well, how does the work reported in these new papers get around some of these limitations?
Well, what these papers show is that by adding other metals to the cathode, now this alters the electronic behavior of the platinum itself. The upshot is that the oxides don't bind quite as readily to the platinum, and it looks like the percentage of platinum atoms blocked by the oxides then drops from about 45% to about 30%. And while this doesn't sound, maybe stupendous perhaps, it allows more oxygen molecules access to the platinum and boosts the rate at which they're split. And in fact, one combination of nickel and platinum appears to work 10 times better than platinum alone, and as much as 90 times better than cathodes used in automotive fuel cells today. And that the other benefit is that with fewer oxides tugging on the platinum atoms, that means that the cathodes seem to be far more stable and resistant to dissolving.
Well, okay, so we have this new work. Where does this leave us, Bob? What are the next steps in this technology?
Well, the next step is to incorporate these secondary metals into real-world catalysts. Now, catalysts in cars have to have a very, very high surface area because it's at these surfaces that the reactions take place. This is normally done by making platinum into very fine particles, nanoparticles, in fact, and then gluing those to high surface area carbon skeletons or some other skeletons. And so the likely strategy going forward will be to create nanoparticles with the right composition of these secondary metals Now, getting such fine particles exactly right won't be easy, but that's the likely strategy a lot of groups will pursue.
And then, of course, there's still the problem of actually getting hydrogen to put in these cars.
Well, there's lots of problems. And the thing is that the cathode is just one of the big hurdles with future hydrogen cars. Researchers also have to find cheap ways to produce hydrogen, and hopefully without using fossil fuels and therefore reducing greenhouse gases. And they also have to find ways to store lots of it on board tanks, like you mentioned. And both of these are major challenges in and of themselves. So even if researchers solve the whole cathode problem, they'll have plenty of work to do to keep them busy.
Oh, Bob, thanks very much for being with us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Bob Service reports on two new studies on fuel cell technology published this week by Science. Just around the corner, the genome sequence of a common human parasite. Stay with us.
Did you know that AAAS members help plug the power of science into public policy? Since 1973, we've brought nearly 2,000 scientists and engineers to Washington, D.C. as science and technology policy fellows. They provide scientific analysis to policymakers in congressional offices and in federal agencies. Find out more at fellowships.AAAS.org. AAAS, advancing science careers, enhancing public policy.
Trichomoniasis, or trich, is an extremely common and often overlooked sexually transmitted disease, with some 170 million cases annually worldwide. Although the disease often causes no problems, in severe cases it's associated with a heightened risk of HIV infection, as well as pregnancy complications such as preterm delivery or low birth weight. This week in Science, a team of 65 researchers reports on the draft genome of Trichomonas vaginalis, the parasite that causes trichomoniasis. The team leader, Jane Carlton of the NYU School of Medicine, joins us now by phone to talk about the work. Dr. Carlton, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
Well, first, Dr. Carlton, I don't want to sound flip, but my understanding is that trichomoniasis is already a treatable disease. Why sequence this organism in particular?
Well, yes, indeed, trich can be treated, but there are only two FDA drugs approved from the same class of compounds, and the real problem is that the parasite is becoming resistant to at least one of these. So it's important to sequence the genome really in order to get the complete repertoire of genes and proteins so that the metabolic pathways and mechanisms of pathogenesis can be identified, and really chinks in the armor of the parasite sort of identified for the development of new drugs.
I see. So it's kind of looking toward the future when these drugs may not be as effective as they are now.
Absolutely.
Tell us a little bit more about this specific parasite that causes this disease.
It's a fascinating organism. It's a protist, so it's a single-celled organism. It's a member of the Parabacillid lineage. It has four anterior flagella. It's got an undulating sort of frilly membrane down one side. It's got a kind of axis style, which is like a tail-like organelle. So it's very motile and it moves around very fast. It has these really interesting organelles called hydrogenosomes, which are very similar to mitochondria. They produce ATP, so they're kind of the power horses of the organism, and also hydrogen. So actually this organism is quite gassy. It gives out large amounts of hydrogen, which causes some of the nasty symptoms as well. One of the symptoms that it causes in women, I should say that men are actually mainly asymptomatic, but in about 50% of cases, women have terrible symptoms of a frothy discharge, which is pretty nasty and has a foul odor. And part of this frothy discharge is probably due to the production of hydrogen from the hydrogenosome. Although men are asymptomatic, in some cases they can get urethritis and prostatitis, but as you mentioned, the main problem in women is an increased risk of infection with HIV-1, which also occurs in men too, due to the disruption of the urogenital tract epithelial cells, which is where the parasite lives. And also a number of pregnancy-associated problems, such as premature delivery and low birth weight. So it's a pretty nasty bug.
Yeah, kind of a nasty little thing. Let's drill down into the sequence itself. I understand in looking at this sequence, you found some rather surprising things about this organism in terms of how its genome is organized and the size of the genome, etc. Could you tell us about some of that?
Oh, absolutely. It was a bit daunting, actually, to say the least. We expected the genome to be approximately 16 megabases. This is similar to the sizes of many other eukaryotic parasites, such as the malaria parasite, which is slightly larger. In fact, when we started to sequence Trichomonas vaginalis, we found that the genome was 160 megabases. That's 10 times as big as we expected. And the main reason for this is actually the genome is chock-a-block with repeats and transposable elements, making up almost 70% of the genome. And the repeats are very similar to each other. They differ by only about 2.5% in their DNA sequence. So, in fact, assembling the genome was incredibly difficult, and it is still in very many pieces. But some of the other really interesting things about the genome, we predicted a large number of genes, more than 26,000, which have been confirmed, with another possible 34,000 which have yet to be confirmed, bringing the total up to close to 60,000 genes which we predict to be in the genome, which is just a phenomenal number.
Yeah, I mean, that's more than humans, is it not?
It is. It's more than humans. And what we found in the genome, actually, and why there are so many genes, is that there's been massive amplification of certain of these gene families. For example, those involved in pathogenesis, actually, in particular, there are close to more than 800 genes, which are proteins probably found on the surface of the parasite, involved in parasite adherence. And this is a very important thing that the parasite does, actually. The parasite must adhere to cells of the urogenital tract, and also more than 400 genes encoding peptidases used in a variety of pathogenic functions, and also amplification of genes and gene families involved in endocytosis and phagocytosis. So the organism actually is quite a voracious sort of phagocytosa of cells. Living in the urogenital tract, it will gobble up red blood cells, the good bacteria that make the vaginal environment a good acidic pH and leading to a healthy, normal environment. So it gobbles those up. It also endocytoses other sexually transmitted bacteria, such as gonorrhea and chlamydia. So it's a pretty nasty bug again.
Well, putting some of the things you've said together, what are some of the things that this sequence tells us about how this organism actually evolved to become the pathogen that it is?
One of the major things that we hypothesize about and speculate about is why Trichomonas vaginalis has such a large genome size. You know, evolutionarily speaking, why would this happen? And what we speculate is that this has been caused by a huge expansion of repeats and gene families in the genome, and that this occurred during the transition of the ancestor of T. vaginalis to the urogenital tract. So the majority of trichomonads are, in fact, found in the intestine, and Trichomonas vaginalis is odd in that it's found in the urogenital tract. So we hypothesize that the increase in the genome size occurred during this transition. And the increase in genome size will also have caused an increase in cell size because the two are positively correlated. And this may have been selected for since a large cell size would then enable the parasite to increase its surface area for colonization of the urogenital tract and really sort of augment its predatory phagocytosis of bacteria and other cells.
Being a larger organism, it was better able to gobble up smaller ones.
Absolutely.
Well, where does this work put us with respect to the new treatments that you were talking about earlier?
Well, we have identified several possible proteins which could be the targets of new drugs. So those are obviously one area to start research into. We also identified several possible mechanisms which the parasite may use to become resistant to the current available drugs. And we've also classified many of the repeats as well. And these can now be used to develop possible nucleic acid diagnostic tests as well. So all in all, it's been a very fruitful genome project. Still lots to do, which will keep us busy for many years to come, I'm sure.
Well, Dr. Carlton, many thanks.
Thank you.
Jane Carlton and 64 colleagues report on the genome sequence of the trichomoniasis pathogen in the January 12th issue of Science. Finally today, David Grimm, the editor of Science's free daily news site, Science Now, is in the studio with Tanisha Riley of AAAS for our usual roundup of other recent stories.
David, welcome back and happy 2007.
Happy New Year to you. Good to see you again.
Thank you. So what's on tap for today?
Well, today, as always, three cool stories, and this time I will phrase the stories in terms of questions. We'll ask, did NASA kill the Martians? And we will also ask, how do you map something that you can't see? And finally, we will ask, how do tropical reef fish find their way home?
Sounds pretty good. So let's start with the Martians. And we killed the Martians? Is that what you're saying?
Well, that's what a team of two scientists are saying, or at least speculating. And their theory comes from two missions from NASA's Viking lander missions in the 1970s. And basically, these landers landed on the Red Planet in 1976 with the mission of looking for Earth-like life on Mars. And what they did was these landers scooped up some samples of the Martian soil, and they tested these this soil for the presence of life. And they did a variety of tests. One test, they added some water to the soil to see if these hypothetical life forms would start drinking the water, basically. And in another test, they actually cooked the sample to see if there was any organic residue left, which would be indicative of life. And those tests all came back negative. And so at least based on those missions, NASA said, hey, well, at least from what we can see so far, there's no life on Mars. But these researchers that are based at the Washington State University in Seattle and a university in Germany said, hold on a minute, let's see, maybe we were looking for the wrong kind of life. We can't assume that all life is like life on Earth. And they said, if we assume that this life was not maybe water-based, but maybe water and hydrogen peroxide-based, the results the Viking landers saw may have made a bit more sense. And that's because if these life forms were hydrogen peroxide-based, they may have actually drowned in the presence of water, and the Viking landers wouldn't have picked that up. And also, if the samples were cooked, any organic residue would have been destroyed by the hydrogen peroxide in these samples, in these life forms, and that wouldn't have been that would have been registered as non-life by the Viking landers, even though it is potentially life.
Now, is this a unanimous feeling, or is there some dissenters against this?
No, it's definitely very controversial. I mean, a lot of scientists say, well, it's an interesting theory, but just because you propose these hypothetical organisms doesn't mean they actually exist, and there's still no direct proof that any of this life actually exists. And one researcher even said, you know, there's really high levels of lethal radiation on the surface of Mars, so even if we assume there could be life on Mars, it should be quickly killed by this radiation. So it doesn't make a whole lot of sense for life forms to exist on the surface like these researchers are proposing. But at least it opens the window a little bit for the possibility of life on Mars. So we'll see.
Okay, we'll see. Okay, great. The next story, someone's made a map of cosmic dark matter.
Right, and the question here is, how do you map something you can't see? And dark matter is something we can't see. It's speculated to make up about 85% of all the matter in the universe, but we can't detect it directly. We just sort of think it's there. And so what researchers did was they wanted to figure out, well, can we sort of figure out how it's distributed in the universe? And the way you detect dark matter is, like I said, you can't see it directly, but these clouds of dark matter tend to distort our visualization of other objects like stars and galaxies. They warp the light signatures from them. So what these researchers did is they took took a group of very powerful telescopes. They used the Hubble telescope in space, and they used a telescope in Hawaii, and they scanned a region of the sky that probably about the space of about 10 moons, about the size of 10 moons, and they looked for these distortions, and then they mapped how far away these light distortions were from Earth, and you know approximately where they were. And by doing that, they came up with this, what they call this three-dimensional map of dark matter in the galaxy, and in the universe, rather. And what's interesting about the map is that the places where they see these really big clumps of dark matter is also where you see the really big clumps of of galaxies and stars and things like that. And that confirms a widely held theory in astronomy, which is basically when dark matter first came onto the scene in the universe, it sort of adapted this sort of clumpy distribution, and these clumps attracted what normal matter, which eventually turned into stars and galaxies and things like that. And this map confirms that. It shows that where we see these big clumps of dark matter, we also see these big clumpings of stars and galaxies and things like that. So it's a nice proof of concept study.
Okay, so what does this map actually tell us?
Well, first of all, it tells us a bit about the distribution of dark matter, but it also tells us a little bit about dark energy, which is this other mysterious phenomenon that's going on in the universe, which is, while dark matter sort of seems to be holding, and gravity seems to be holding the universe together, this force called dark energy is trying to blow the universe apart. And the more scientists know about how dark matter is distributed, the more they may know about how it interacts with dark energy and just exactly what dark energy is and what it's doing out there.
All right, and finally, David, back down to planet Earth. Something completely different, as
right,
they say.
Right. We'll get off astronomy for this last story and talk about tropical reef fish. And the question with tropical reef fish is that when a lot of these fish are born, they're larvae and they're swept away by the ocean currents. At least that's the theory. They're hatched on the reef, but these ocean currents sweep them away to places unknown. But that contradicts with what biologists observe in the wild, and what they see is that all these reef communities are very biodiverse. There are a number of different types of species on these communities, and for a single species to become biodiverse and to branch into more species, it has to have a lot of its relatives around to mate with it, or a lot of organisms that have a very similar genetic makeup. And the reason for that is because if you've got a species that's, say, divided onto five different reefs, and if each reef keeps sort of the same genetic makeup say reef A has one genetic makeup and reef B has a different genetic makeup, as long as you keep your close relatives around, you're going to maintain that genetic makeup. You're going to stay genetically distinct from a species on a different, from a subspecies on a different reef. But how does that happen? Because how do you get all your relatives together if your relatives are being swept away every time they're born? So what the researchers wondered is, do these fish have some way of figuring out how to get back to their home reef once they get swept away? And they tested a few varieties of reef fish. One was called a cardinal fish, and another one is called a spiny damsel fish. And what they found was that when they put these fish in flumes that contain either water from their home reef or foreign water, the fish spent a lot more time in the water from their home reefs. And the researchers speculate that the fish can somehow smell the water of their home reef, and they use this to get back home once they get swept away by the ocean current. And that could help explain how these reefs keep so many genetically similar types of fish together, because these fish are basically finding their way back home again.
Wow, it's interesting. Thanks, David. I'll see you next time then.
See you next time.
David Grimm is the editor of Science Now, the free online daily news service of science. You can catch up with these and other stories on his site at sciencenow.sciencemag.org.
And that wraps up the January 12, 2007 Science Podcast. The show is a production of Science Magazine and of AAAS, the Science Society, with additional financial support from the Golden Fund. The content is provided by the news and editorial staff of Science, and Jeffrey Cook composed the music for the show. I'm Stuart Wills, the online editor of Science, on behalf of the journal and its publisher, the American Association for the Advancement of Science. Thanks for joining us.